KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and a visiting research collaborator this year at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I have a guest on the show that I am very excited to have on, an unusual guest for Hearsay Culture, where we focus heavily on intellectual property law, technology law and policy, communications, but we also talk about media, and to a much lesser extent, but we talk about the music industry in the context of primarily copyright. Today, I'm excited to have on the founder and editor of the magazine The Big Takeover. And The Big Takeover is a magazine that has had over 75 print issues come out over the last 30-plus years at this point, focusing primarily on the new wave and punk movement, but then also other alternative music styles. The editor and founder of the magazine, our guest today, Jack Rabbit, built this magazine, and we'll talk a little bit about it, from his apartment in Lower Manhattan, and moved it from what amounted to a pamphlet, if you will, to, at this point, and I'm looking at the most recent edition of the magazine, or at least most recent one that I have, which is actually edition number 75, which is dated from this year. And I'm looking at that magazine now, and I am looking at about a couple of hundred pages, 136 pages, full of all kinds of interesting information. When you think about a music magazine, I think the gold standard, though we may ask Jack this, might be Rolling Stone. And Rolling Stone has certainly done a good job in recent years, not only covering music, but, with the exception of some of the reporting issues involving University of Virginia, have done a lot of investigative reporting. In The Big Takeover, this is my own personal view, exactly what you'd want out of music reporting. Jack and his staff, and there are a number of contributors to the magazine, are exceptionally knowledgeable about the music that they are covering. And so in every issue of The Big Takeover, there are dozens of detailed reviews of artists, most of which you or anyone would not have heard of unless you are paying very close attention to the music industry. And these reviews are not just saying this is good or this isn't, but compares and contrasts the music to the history of music, certainly going back at least 50 years, and talks about why you might enjoy the music and what's great about it. On top of all of that, the magazines also have a lot of commentary about the music business and music venues, and so it's very exciting. By way of one example, in volume 73 of The Big Takeover, which has the musician and artist Johnny Marr on the cover, Jack wrote an editorial entitled Farewell to Maxwell's Fond Memories and the Cost of Gentrification. And this is with reference to Maxwell's, the music venue in Hoboken, New Jersey, that closed last year. And we are recording, I should note, on March 4th, 2015. And Jack wrote, and this is a lengthy editorial, he wrote, "I estimate I attended 300 shows there, of which about 15 or 20 I was in the band. I loved going there every time because it was also the best social scene for concerts. I usually showed up a few hours early and never seemed to leave until an hour after the band quit. That was my kind of club, and there are less of them now. Too many of my city's current venues," and I think he's referring to New York City generally, or broadly, or maybe the tri-state area, "have velvet ropes with walkie-talkie security clearing the hall 5 expletive minutes after thank you, good night. Just when you can finally talk to people you recognize. At Maxwell's," Jack writes, "neither musicians, fans, nor bartenders expressed any desire that you scram. One more round, please." And it's this style of really interesting, fun, and insightful writing that has been, in my view, the hallmark of The Big Takeover, and why I started subscribing to it, and I've subscribed on and off as my life has gone forward over the last 20 years. For the copyright and IP nerds out there, I will also note that Jack has a hilarious copyright notice in Volume 75, which begins, contents copyright 2014, Rodent Productions, open parens, not owned by, quote, Americans for Prosperity, nor Americans for Poverty, Stagnation, and Misery either, close parens. Please don't reprint any of this issue's contents without consent, parens usually granted, close parens. If you do, however, we'll put you on a plane to Liberia if any American can find Liberia on a map and serve at an Ebola ward in the nude. Don't worry, it's not contagious, and goes on and on from there. So we have a bit of certainly pointed copyright humor, which continues in the magazine. Jack is, like I said, a real pioneer in the music industry, and his writing in this area, I think, is very exciting. We're going to talk today not only about the big takeover, but about his views on the music business, as well as his transition of his magazine from print, which he still does, online. So Jack is joining us via Skype from his home in Park Slope, Brooklyn. We are recording again on March 4th, 2015. Jack, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
After that nice build-up, I'm even more glad to be here.
So let me start off here. Like I said, I promised Jack before we started, I'm going to try to not make this a fawning interview, even though I'm a big admirer of his work. Jack, I did the most rudimentary of biographies. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you came to start the big takeover.
Well, I grew up in the New Jersey suburbs, not in Hoboken, a little further out, and was destined for a very normal, completely usual suburban life, I guess, completely unurban, or so it seemed. And being that I was only 20 miles from New York, urban culture sort of grabbed me, and particularly the punk rock scene of the late 1970s at Naxos, Kansas City, and CBGBs and places like that. I had some friends who got into it and just insisted that I get into it too, and I tried resisting and failed. Pretty soon I was going with them to every gig and buying every record and buying every magazine in those pre-internet days of the late 1970s. And I was a teenager and I was in high school. So it was an exciting time to be like hanging around an extremely derelict city, you know, where the laws just were not enforced, and meet musicians, you know, who were in their late 20s who'd been in the New York Dolls and stuff like that. And here's me just coming from the suburbs. I'm a big nobody, you know, studying for my geometry quiz or something. It was quite an interesting time to be a teenager if you could find yourself in New York somehow. I'm lucky that I did.
And so the big takeover kind of came out of that. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That sort of inspiration will run the rest of your life. And here it is, you know, 36, 37 years later, and I'm still inspired by that.
As I mentioned the history of the magazine before we, you know, get into some of your perspectives on things, it's fascinating because I described the, from what I've seen, and I didn't have access to the big takeover when you started out, but it looks like it was something, you know, you typed up on a typewriter and kind of handed out in your neighborhood. So is that a fair description of how the magazine began?
Yeah, the first issue was 100 dimes at the Summit New Jersey Public Library, back when copy machines used to take about 40, 45 seconds to make one copy. So there was a pretty long line that formed behind us. It was me and my best friend, Dave Stein. It was his idea to do a magazine, and I told him I'd help him. And it was one page. We didn't even type on the, you know, opposite side of the page. We still sell that, I think, for like 40 cents to cover, or 45 cents or whatever, to cover the postage. But, you know, it's just impossible for people to reach back. This was June of 1980, and there was no copy shops that I knew of at that time. There was no personal computers. Everything was, even in like the movie business, they were still doing pay stuff. You know, it's impossible for people to realize now, if they weren't around at that time, how technologically different things were.
Now, how do you describe, I described your magazine, but how do you describe it? What is its focus and what is its purpose?
Well, I think my genuine philosophy is that somewhere in the late 1960s, early 70s, the music business turned its back on music. You know, like through the 40s, 50s, 60s, they identified talent, and then after that devised a marketing plan for it. You know, I'm being wholly general here. You know, like I think the Beatles probably wouldn't have gotten signed if they weren't funny and good looking. You know, and Elvis Presley was white. You know, there were certainly commercial concerns as opposed to just whatever you could put on a tape. But for the most part, I think people thought like, oh, he's good or she's good, I can sell that. And then somewhere in the, probably the mid-70s or so, it was more like a focus on marketing instead of talent, especially with the advent of multi-track recording technology. The actual ability to set down a track quickly was no longer valued, so you didn't have to be greatly talented anymore. And then you kind of get to this place where someone like a Los Angeles Lakers cheerleader gets signed after MTV comes along because she can dance. And she can't sing a note. She's still a celebrity. I'm not even going to say her name because it disgusts me to this day, but she's often a talent judge on singing competitions on TV these days. But she had absolutely no musical talent at all, and she had like 5 number one hits because she could dance her way through a video. I mean, that's how badly things devolved. Whereas people like me still really deeply care about music, and the marketing aspect is really immaterial to us. So we just set out looking for people whose music is deeply moving and deeply human and deeply exciting, or you know, not so completely polished and sanitized for your protect day that all of the heart and life and humanity has been stripped out of it. I mean, I guess most of the world is still listening to stuff like Katy Perry or something like that. And I think as a personality, she's quite interesting. But as a musician, the music that she makes, you know, because of the production techniques that are applied to what she does, you can't hear her anymore. She's not even there. I can't even tell if she can sing or not. Whereas the music I like is extremely straightforward. I think it's, you know, it's really meant much like a Beatles record or a Hank Williams record or a Louis Armstrong record that just punch you right in the frickin' gut. That's what I like.
And so let me get at this, and of course, I should note or certainly remind you. All right, so we're on KZSU FM Stanford, and so this is a college radio station, which I think many many people that share your view college radio as perhaps the last at least traditional bastion of ways that music can be organized and shared with the public. Obviously, YouTube and the internet changes all of that. But perhaps I'll ask you this related question before I come back to ask you about the kinds of focuses that you have in the Big Takeover. Given that criticism of the music industry, what role do you see traditional radio, and particularly college radio, having in attempting to counterweight the marketing and corporate structure around the creation and dissemination of music today? Is there a role?
Well, again, without trying to make myself sound like some kind of old geezer, for those who are younger than me, it's really probably impossible to remember a time before the internet. Whereas from like 1977 to say 1994, when the internet finally got more widespread, we had nothing but college radio. There was no other venue that could disseminate the sort of music we were interested in. And there were probably 300 or 400 college radio stations that had at least 1 or 2 DJs playing the stuff we liked. So all over the country, I would tune in. Like if I was in L.A., I would listen to KXLU, or if I was in a place like Atlanta, I would just turn the dial, and everything was just garbage, you know, on the radio. It was all this top 40 pablum and kind of like bland talk radio and boring news, and then you'd get this song that would completely, you know, say, hey, this must be the college radio station. These people are actually playing something good, you know, and anybody who was on an independent label in particular, I'd rely on college radio to play their music because the MTV and the major radio stations all across the country were sewn up by the 6 major labels of that time, like Warner Brothers and Sony and Universal. So it was really a revolt in a way. It was an access and opportunity for people who actually genuinely cared about music to find like-minded people, and people just turning the dial would find it. Now, in the internet age, the college radio still has a play, I think, because the problem with the internet, with things like Pandora and Spotify and whatnot, is that people are just using word of mouth and algorithms just kind of blithely search for themselves looking for music. Whereas an extremely knowledgeable DJ on a good station, you know, will attract people just to check out what he or she is playing. And they need time to run the air, because that's a gold mine, I think, for people who are looking for music that isn't being promoted with tons of money behind it.
When I think of the role of radio stations today, it is along those lines, and I also think of internet radio as well. One of the stations that I listen to a lot on the internet is a station called Radio Paradise, which I think has a lot of overlap with the kinds of music that you write about in The Big Takeover. Yeah, as I look at and I pulled up KZSU's current list of top 10 albums, you've got artists like Gengras, Sleater-Kinney, Bell and Sebastian, Bork, Scheller Tollermeyer, which I will confess to not be familiar with, Jose Gonzalez, a band called Viet Cong, Panda Bear, Davila 666, and Siskiyou. I think probably Sleater-Kinney, Bell and Sebastian, and Bjork would be the biggest names, and probably Bjork is the most well-known. But you look at these labels, and of course, you know, who knows who the labels are. When you think about, and I want to turn back to Big Takeover in a moment, but I want one more follow-up question. When you think about the kinds of music that's played both on internet radio stations and on college radio stations as compared to Pandora and Spotify and Songza and these others, that as you point out, are driven by algorithms, what do you see as the role of algorithms and of computers in making music selections? In other words, is it all bad, or are there any benefits that you might think of with that kind of technology and disseminating the good music that to which you point?
Well, I think, you know, good and bad are maybe not the right words.
Fair enough.
Maybe better, best, least, poorest. You can definitely find something with an algorithm. I mean, there are times when, you know, I guess Amazon or something might actually hit upon by accident a recommendation that actually does suit your taste. But I think it's much better and much faster to find like-minded individuals or a station of that sort who are playing a nice cross-section of stuff that you might like. You might not like all of it. You might like some of it and love some of it. But to me, the goal is truly to find the artists that really mean the most to you and the songs and albums that mean the most to you. And it's going to take a fair amount of sampling to find it. It's just a narrowing of the field if you find a good station. The nice thing about internet radio for me is, like, I never could listen to a station like KEXP unless I happen to be in Seattle. And I tend to be in Seattle a couple weeks a year, but the other 50 weeks, I'm not. And in the past, that just meant I was out of luck. And in the last 20 years, it's meant that anytime I want to, I can just tune into KEXP. A lot of good DJs, and maybe you find one or two that are really going well tonight, and you check it out. I mean, there are just so many sources. I can't listen to any of them religiously. Plus, being a music magazine editor, I'm getting tons of music sent to me, submitted to the magazine for potential review. I think it's just incumbent upon anyone who cares about music to try any source they can, and the ones that are most consistent and feeding them the music that means the most to them are the ones you should just keep hitting like a slot machine that keeps paying off. Ding.
We're talking to Jack Rabard, the editor and founder of the Big Takeover magazine on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Jack, let me turn back to your magazine before we then, after the break, talk more broadly, and you started talking about the music industry. As it stands today, you've got, like I said, you've got a ton of content in the magazine, driven by advertising as any magazine does. And, you know, if I look at the most recent volume, you've got advertisements from record stores, you've got lists of different albums that are being released, you've got notifications about books and down the list. As a print magazine founder and editor, what do you want your print magazine to do today, and how is it augmented by your website?
Well, obviously the easiest thing is to play music for people instead of describing it. And that's something I do as well. I have my own radio show I've been doing 6.5 years it just moved to a new home. But for people who want to hear the music that I feel the most about, you can just go to bigtakeover.com/radio and listen to any of my... I think that's a great thing. But even if you listen to my show, for example, and you hear me back announce songs, I think the role of print or even just web stuff is that it can give you some background. It can give you some food for thought beyond what you're hearing. You know, like some people, they watch their favorite TV shows, and now in the age of the internet, then they watch an hour-long discussion about the show they just watched. I'm the sort of guy who always wanted to do that. You know, like if I went to the movies with my friends, it would annoy me if we'd all say goodbye the second the movie ended, not only because I'm a social creature, but I often want to discuss the movie we just saw, you know, with the three or four people I went with. You understand? I think the role of a good website magazine or a good print magazine is that it can completely enliven and enrich, you know, the things behind the music. You know, who made it, what they were influenced by, what else they've been involved with, what songs that they cover, you know, some of the humor behind the music, the history of the sound or the scene or whatever. There's just so much you can talk about, and also tell you people what it reminds you of and bring some of your knowledge to bear, as you say, that would actually be of value to someone beyond just hearing the song and saying, I like it and I don't, or I don't.
When you see the print world today and the magazine world today, you know, you've been able to maintain a magazine, you know, pretty well, and you have correct me if I'm wrong, you have about two print issues per year, but then you also have, as you mentioned, your online content. For people that are thinking about this kind of print media, you know, what kinds of lessons do you think you've learned about being able to put a high quality, thoughtful print edition of a magazine together in an age of websites? You know, again, I want to talk more broadly about the music industry after the break, but in terms of print media, what do you do today?
You don't.
Okay, fair enough.
The print magazine industry is on a death watch. It's been, you know, it's like a patient that's told that he has inoperable cancer and he could live years or he could live another decade. You know, there's no way of knowing, but you're going to die. And you're going to be sick while you're doing that. That said, you know, if you value someone's life or if you value your own life, you do try to extend it as far as you can, because it's the only one you have. And I think print magazines are much superior to internet. I read a lot of the stuff on the internet like everybody else. It has its place, it has its value. But my proviso is that most of the stuff that gets read on the internet is very ephemeral. People read it once and then they never read it again. And they often don't think about it again because there's just such a smorgasbord, there's such a plethora of things to read. It doesn't really get deep into their consciousness after they've read it. Whereas the nice thing about print, and I find this true with reading the New York Times or reading a book, for example, is print on the page seems to engage you more, I think. And I'm really heartened by the endless amount of people who tell me they keep our magazine. They don't throw them out the way they do some, like, you know, supermarket cereal or something. You know, like, people are still like pulling a magazine I wrote in 1983 off the shelf and reading it and quoting it back to me. That's extraordinary to me. I don't think people are doing that with the internet. People are not going back to something I wrote in 1996 and published in Jam TV and saying, like, hey, great piece you wrote there. You know, they're just not. I like things that last. You know, I mean, Hank Williams died 10 years before I was born, and I'm still listening to him. You know, Jimmy Rogers made all his recordings 35 years before I was born, and I'm still listening to him, too. All the stuff I liked when I was a teenager, a lot of those people are still making great albums to this day, even aside from the recordings they made then. I think that is the point of culture, is to find things that are not ephemeral, to find things that are the opposite. And print magazines are a great, great way to do that if you can keep them going. As I was alluding to, though, all the forces of technology in the marketplace are against print magazines. And they're especially against anyone devoted to music, because the music business is also on a death watch of sorts. So people like us are squeezed in both directions. On the one hand, our primary advertisers are musicians and record labels, and they're selling far less than they used to, because everybody gets their music for free. And on the other end is the death of bookstores and newsstands. So it's finding a lot harder to actually disseminate, to actually distribute the physical products that we're selling to people who might be interested in buying. So it's not a good thing to be starting right now, and almost nobody is. But the one benefit of having done this now for 34 years and 9 months is that because we're this established, people are still willing to support us, and people are still willing to buy us. And just like the New York Times, people who do prefer to read stuff, you know, at their coffee table or on the airplane and without benefit of a device, you know, with a screen, they are still supporting us as well.
So you know, I want to talk about the music industry after the break, and particularly your comment about the death watch of the music industry, and we can probe that. But on the print side, you know, I was reading an article yesterday, and I don't have it in front of me, but I read an article yesterday in The Independent, the UK newspaper, indicating an uptick in book sales. Now, of course, because it is the typical media hook efforts towards leads, the title of the article, you know, was the something like along the lines of the decline of ebooks, which I think is overstating it greatly. But you know, to the extent that you have a theory for why one would want to look back in a print magazine versus a web page, do you have any thoughts on why that, in fact, would be the case? Because we do have, for example, the Internet Archive. There is archive.org where you can go to web pages. But I grant you, and I grant you that I think there's something to that. Why do you think print media has that pull, if you will, in readers in a way that the Internet doesn't?
Again, something about a physical object. We're seeing this now in the relative, and I say relative, resurgence of vinyl. Where you know, vinyl was itself almost completely stamped out and disappeared, almost like 8-tracks were, or cassettes used to be. And we're actually seeing an increase in sales of vinyl because people really do want to touch something. They want to look at something and have something. Now, part of that is just fetishization. I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but people know what I'm saying. Right. Some people just like to fetishize a thing, you know. A lot of people who buy vinyl apparently don't even play it. They just want to have it. They put it on their wall to look at, or, you know, they take the download their iPod or whatever and don't actually bother to play the vinyl despite its supposedly superior audio quality. But I think people aren't so much like fetishizing a book. They don't buy the book because it has some nice artwork on the cover. I think there really is a tactile difference in holding a book in your hand, or a print magazine in your hand. The experience of reading is much more pleasant, I think, and it seems to engage the brain a lot more, in my experience, because again, I read a lot of stuff on the internet. I'm not trying to be a Luddite here. I'm just trying to explain that I do find value in buying other people's magazines and sitting down on an airplane or at my coffee table or whatever, reading the New York Times. I find it much, I mean, I can read the New York Times online, and I often do if I'm out of town, but I really much prefer reading it in the paper so much that I don't read the articles the night before, even though a lot of times they're available. I will wait for the morning for my paper to come. It's just so much better. I also find it easier to navigate stuff in magazines and newspapers because I can very quickly look around, read a paragraph of this, you know, get a gist of what this article is and decide if I want to keep reading beyond just with the headline hook. There's a lot of advantages, I think, and some of it is just the ease and the beauty of pulling out a magazine off the shelf or a book off the shelf and just sitting down and enjoying it for a little while. I guess lastly, the other point is that I'm sure this is true of a lot of people, not just me. I spend way too much of my time staring at computers. Like 9/10 of my business requires a computer, so much so that whenever my computer is in the shop, you know, I'm completely hamstrung and I'm completely debilitated. I might as well have had my arms and legs cut off in terms of, you know, conducting my business and my social affairs and doing anything. So the opportunity to do something pleasurable without having to look in my screen is not only a nice rest for my eyes, but it's a rest for my, you know, my sense of peace, of tranquility in my brain. I mean, maybe this is what people used to do when they'd sit in a big long chair with a cigar and a night table lamp, you know, and just read for 2 hours at the end of a difficult day, back before there were so many other choices, before there was radio and before there was television, before there was the internet and everything else besides video games and iPhones and you know, cinema.
Right.
You have to actually, in this case, put yourself back in the 1870s, you know what I mean?
No, and that's, you know, and
people, you know, people would read a Dickens novel serialized in a magazine in 1870.
Right.
And that was really great for them. Do you really want to read a Dickens novel on your e-reader? I mean, I guess people do.
No, and then, you know, look, and that model yet, you know, still seems to be the one that we're assuming, even if, you know, I think you make some valid points about the physical attributes, not only of ownership, but just of the tactile nature of an object. We're chatting with Jack Rabid, the founder and editor of the Big Takeover magazine, which you can find at bigtakeover.com, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU-FM, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its truly diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. I should also note that I recognize there are some connection issues in today's show with regard to Skype. However, I appreciate your indulgence, and I think for 98% of what you're hearing, it is audible, but my apologies, and I'll continue to tinker with the connection as we continue the interview. So, Jack, let me come back to your comment earlier about the death of the music business, because, you know, certainly if you go on raw numbers, you know, if you read articles in the Hollywood Reporter and industry magazines, you know, there's no loss of money being made in the music industry, but perhaps the issue is how you define the music industry. So, do you want to say a bit more about how you see the music industry also, you know, being at death's door?
Well, to me, the music industry, as it was, at least since 1949, was the sale of albums, and supplemented by the sale of singles, which was all they had from like 1890 till 1949. Everything was a single up until then. And, you know, the LP technology hadn't been invented yet. So from, the, say, 1949 on, we're talking about the sale of albums. Now, to me, in the internet age, we're not even talking about the sale of music. Certainly to the extent that people still buy music, they seem to buy it in little bits, a one-song download of iTunes. And even then, most people just seem to either get it for free somehow, because why be a chump and spend 99 cents or whatever when you can get it for free in so many different sources? Or they're getting it from subscription-based things, either for free from something like Spotify, if they don't feel like paying the monthly rate, or for a nominal fee, actually paying the monthly rate. But to me, this is not the music business as I know it. And yet, there's no less demand for music. There's always been demand for music. Remember, the recording industry only began in like 1882 with the phonograph, but the actual music business could stretches back thousands of years. I say this before, like a big hit in the 1870s or 1880s would have been how many sheet music that you sold. Like instead of a million people listening to one version of a song, you know, like Taylor Swift or something, back then you had sheet music for a song, and a million people made their own version, standing around a piano, and that was an entertainment, again, because there wasn't so many entertainment options back then. A lot of dinner parties would end with people standing around the piano and singing, you know, the new popular tunes that were getting distributed by sheet music. And before sheet music, even, you had, you know, traveling musicians playing the lyre or the lute or something. They're maybe not the most respected characters in the world, but people have always wanted music. It goes back to the beginning of human time. And now you have so many people recording and so many people touring. There's just an endless array of music that you could sample and try. I think what people are doing now is instead of spending money on recordings, because they can get so many of them for free, they're spending them on concert tickets. That's what's going on here. So you have a really thriving concert business, and the extent that bands and singers can still make any living these days, it seems to be on the road.
Now, so there it is, and I guess my follow-up for you is that an acceptable progression of the music industry to maintain, again, the kinds of music that you want to consume, or do you see that as being unsustainable?
It's both. Now, you mentioned at the start of this little bit how your station is, listener-supported. I think what we're having here is kind of a patron element, kind of like Mozart needed to be funded by the local rich baron or something like that, who would commission his pieces, you know what I mean? I think what we're having now is more of a crowdfunding thing, where instead of one local, George Allen person comes in and says, hey, I really like your band, here's, $100,000 a year so you can continue to make music without a day job, and so you can go on tour and not have to constantly look for a new job when you get back. I think what you're having here is that people who really love this music and see the worth in it are having to support it themselves. When a band goes on tour, for example, I see a lot of them these days are manning their own merchandise booth. And they'll even say from the stage, merchandise booth, I will be there if you want to have your stuff signed. Which is just a brilliant strategy, I think, because people will hang around and they do want to talk to the band. They don't want them to go backstage and just chill out. They want to actually say, hey, great show, I liked your band, and yes, I would like to support you directly. I would like to buy your CD or your bag or your button or your beer cozy or whatever and have you sign it and just, make sure the money is going straight to you so you can continue making more records so that I can see you like we did tonight when you came to our town. I know it costs money to get in a van. I know it costs money to buy the gas and keep the strings and picks and the drum heads together and buy hotel rooms and feed yourself and everything. I think people really do have to get more directly involved because there is less money for album sales. Even if you were only selling 10 or 15,000 before of your album, that money used to go in your pocket. I think people really do have to do that. To that extent, for instance, I used to have a radio show for 7 years where I was getting paid to do it, and I lost that recently. So the new radio show that I've launched, I'm not getting paid for anymore. So what I did is I started an account at patreon.com. So if you go to patreon.com/JRabbit, then people can send me a couple dollars every month or, $5 a month or something to basically back me in making these radio shows. And because the radio show I did used to subsidize the magazine to a certain degree, people who are my patrons now are helping to subsidize the magazine as well. So, if you like what I do, that is a direct way, much like if you like the Stanford station, you can get involved in making sure it remains viable. Now, I think that's a great thing people can do, and I'm starting to do it as well.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's interesting because, Hearsay Culture, for example, is a show that I started when I was a fellow at Stanford. I do it on my own, but when I say I do it on my own, what I mean is the recording equipment I purchased, the time that I put into it is my time. No one pays me for it, and yet, of course, right, I distribute it through KZSU, right, which is at Stanford University, which means that KZSU, and I'm grateful for this, of course, right, not only do they air the show, but they also have a DJ or someone who's at the board to make sure that the show airs, and then when it becomes a podcast, my colleagues at the Center of Internet Society convert it into something that can be distributed through the network. Now, what are these costs? I mean, they're not gigantic costs, but they are time costs. They are expense costs. People do have other things they can do. And I have always, in my mind, toyed with, should I be asking for some kind of support along the lines of what you described? But of course, the big difference difference here is that this radio show, Hearsay Culture, while it's not something I'm required to do as part of being a law professor, it definitely ties into my paid job. And so in an indirect sense, I am being paid to the extent that Elon University thinks it's a good thing that I do it, to the extent that Stanford wants it and the like. And so, you know, the ways that people can support these kinds of endeavors that don't have direct lines of revenue, I think, is another big challenge today. So let me ask you this question, which I'm very curious to get your response to. You know, a lot of what we discuss on the show involves this fundamental question of piracy, right? Of the theft of, and we can talk about music, but it's any, you know, works. You know, again, data suggests today that music piracy, the stealing of music, is not as big a problem relative to the industry as the theft of film. But with regard to piracy, one of the big issues, in fact, the biggest issue, has been the question of how much the law should penalize and punish pirates. And this, and I recognize you're not a lawyer, so I'm not asking about the law as much as although you're welcome to take a position on it, but really the law's role here. Because a lot of the battle, certainly the battle that Larry Lessig, who founded CIS, engaged in and others have engaged in, is the question of how much of works of authorship like music can be used without permission, and how should piracy or copyright infringement be dealt with, how much should the penalties be, and the like. So again, recognizing you're not a lawyer, and I'm not asking about the law, but I'm really asking about how serious a problem you think piracy is to the music industry.
Well, there's always been pirates. I mean, it used to be foreign countries. Like, if you had an album out in 20 or 30 territories, you'd get a nice royalty check for those territories. But someplace like China, they would just be doing, or Italy, for example, they'd be doing bootlegs. I mean, bootlegs used to be what we called piracy back in the day.
Right.
And often it was like demos or live recordings that the artist hadn't okayed for release, that somebody just leaked out on pressing them up themselves, you know, illicitly. But these days, piracy is often just the commercial recordings themselves that the artist is completely behind. And I don't even think we should even call it piracy anymore. I mean, the cat is out of the bag, at least since Radiohead actually acknowledged that the cat was out of the bag in a kind of ingenious way when it came out with that album that said pay what you want. You know, I mean, that was a long time ago already. We were discussing this years ago. We are now in kind of the pay what you want economy, I think. And if we really want to support artists who make books and make films and make albums, we should definitely try to buy their stuff at a somewhat regular price, or just below regular price, or maybe more than regular price if we have some deep pockets. We should definitely vote with our wallets to support people who are trying to do something merely because they want us to like it, not because, oh wow, you know, this is, you know, commercial drivel that ought to fool the masses. I always think about this in terms of like this Brian Williams controversy.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, what is the role of TV news these days? Is it to inform us, or is it to entertain us? And I think it's true of almost all the media that we consume these days. The commercial forces are making it so it's trivialized. I mean, if I want to watch a cat video, I could probably do so on my own on YouTube without Brian Williams' help. I go to a foreign nation and I watch something like the BBC, and I'm amazed at the range of information they give out that might actually be useful to my life. You know, or if I'm watching CNN International instead of CNN when I'm out of the country, I'm like, hey, these people actually get real news. Why do we get utter garbage? You know, that's really nothing more like, okay, there's a big storm system coming up the East Coast. Let's send about 20 reporters to stand around the snow. You know what I mean? Like, while real things are happening in the world. I think this is about the music business, too. While people are buying, like, Gwen Stefani records, to me, like, a band like Swerve Driver is coming out with a new album that will just knock people's socks off if only there was any marketing campaign behind it. If only there was, you know, a record label, you know, spending lots of money promoting it. But those days are over. And yet Swerve Driver has a new album out, and they are touring. And, you know, people have a chance to see them precisely because there are people still buying albums trying to support Swerve Driver. They're still buying concert tickets and buying merchandise from them straight from their table. You know, and there's all these Bandcamp pages where you can pay like $6 for an album, go straight to the band. So the bands are eking out a very meager existence, enough to continue, in part because it is so cheap to make a record these days compared to where it used to be. If it's a bigger problem for film, it's because it still takes a couple $1 million to make a movie.
Right.
Even the cheapest movies require a stunning amount of money just to get them going. So you always see these crowdfunding things for them. But even a band needs a couple $1,000, often 5 or 10 or 15 or 20, to make an album, or even aside from the recording aspect of it, to launch it and be a band. You know, to do something other than just have a 9-to-5 job in one town and being anchored to that town. To be a traveling musician is going to cost some money. And you know, the same thing from where I look. You know, to put out a print magazine, I've got to come up with $25,000 every 6 months, which a web magazine does not. So it's important that people do directly support me. So, if they like what I do, if they don't, forget it, obviously.
So, Jack, we're at the point of the show, which I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking questions that you don't have time to answer adequately. But then I ask them anyway, speaking of just running things the way I want to. So we have about 7 minutes left. And let me ask you, you know, this by way of another follow-up on this issue, because I alluded to it with the excerpt that I read from your eulogy to Maxwell's in Hoboken, New Jersey. You know, there is a related issue involving venues, right, and venues for actually seeing live music. And there's been an increasing amount of reporting on the closing of not just music venues, but all kinds of different historic venues in New York City. And you know, I'm thinking about reports not just, you know, about Maxwell's, but I saw a piece yesterday showing the destruction of Roseland Ballroom. And in fact, now the roof is off of it, and you can see inside. And the author was bemoaning the loss of not just Roseland, but what the author referred to as really the cultural history of New York City. I'm a huge fan of Knishes. I make no bones about that. And Yonah Schimmel's down on the Lower East Side, which I know you live near, you know, is another, you know,
that
venerable
corner, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming you enjoyed many a Knish. I don't know. But be that as it may, right? I mean, these places, they're one of a kind, and they're not going to be replaced. What any comments on the loss of venues? And I'm speaking specifically about New York City, but you can make it broader and its impact on what we do with music. Hello.
I'm sorry, I lost you for a second.
Okay. Why don't we? Yeah, we can continue. So go ahead.
Well, I think you know there's money. You know, there's money is always going to be part of our lives. It's always going to dictate some of the culture. But from my standpoint, this is something I do in my magazine. I'm also interested in the culture apart from money. When a place like Roseland closes or CBGB's closes, or Maxwell's, or Yonah Schimmel, or anything. You know, a lot of the times it's just economic forces, the forces of gentrification, forces of profit. It's very difficult for outside groups to come in and say, no, this has cultural significance, this business, and we need to save it. And people have made this mistake so many times. I mean, people are still lamenting that we knocked down the original Penn Station in the early 1960s. What a travesty! What an absolute catastrophe. One of the most beautiful buildings architecturally in the entire city. We, you know, Penn Station in its place underground below Madison Square Garden. For gosh sakes. The Cavern Club, where the Beatles made famous, you know, they knocked that down to build a subway. You know, next door to where it used to be. I mean, stuff like that is just insane to me. Just insane.
So,
absolutely. I think that people need to preserve their culture if they can, but it's difficult to fight against market forces because market forces are so prevalent.
And so that's where, you know, and we've come full circle because I want to come back to this. So one of the, you know, one of the responses, and it is, it's going to sound like a cold response, but it is a response is, well, you know what? Roseland had its time, but now you can watch a band by streaming the show. You can go to other venues. You have YouTube. There are other ways to consume music. And so technology, so the argument would go, has counterweighted the loss of places like Roseland. I suspect I know the answer or your response to it, but I may not. And the purpose of an interview is not to answer the questions that I pose. What's your response to that? I mean, can technology perhaps not replace Roseland, but create a new way that we can consume music that itself has benefits, or are these indelible marks that technology and really nothing can fix?
Well, these days they sell tickets for hologram Elvis Presley and hologram Tupac Shakur, right? I mean, you can actually buy a ticket to see the real Elvis Presley, the real... from where I stand, these people are metaphysically challenged.
So let me ask you this, Jack.
I don't want to actually see the dead perform.
Yeah, I share that, and I can only imagine if I put my two young sons in front of that, what their reaction would be.
Who pays money?
Yes, yeah. Who pays for that?
Money for lots of things. Yeah. I admit. Yeah. Why do you want to go see Elvis? You know, reincarnated on your stage during a concert? Because technology now permits it. You know, pretty soon there'll be the robot Louis Armstrong, you know, or the robot Tony Bennett, whatever your thing is. And when Tony Bennett gets too old to perform, he'll send out his robot. I think Kraftwerk was sort of on this before everybody else, and maybe 50 years from now, people will be seeing robots, you know, completely replicate a live concert experience for people. But for me, technology is not about streaming a lot. I like watching concert videos, don't get me wrong, but it's not the same as actually being in a club watching someone sing or play their instruments. I mean, come on, this is just ridiculous. This is absolutely fabulously ridiculous. And maybe Roseland is the victim of market forces because there's more money to be made in putting something else there or putting concerts in other venues. But the historic nature of things is something that we lose at our own cost. You know, if the market forces, we can find absolutely no way for there to be a commercial use for a historic venue, then that's our loss. And just because it happened doesn't mean that we can't lament it and say that this is an outrage.
So Jack Rabid, the editor of Big Takeover magazine and founder, like I said, enormous fan of the magazine. I'm thrilled that I've had you on the show. I do invite you back. I would be remiss, and you alluded to it earlier, but I'd be remiss in not asking you perhaps the best question and the first question I should have asked, which is, what are you listening to right now, and what do you recommend? You mentioned Swerve Driver's new album, but you know, do you want to throw out any other artists or albums that have recently been released, or you think are going to be released soon that you recommend to my listeners?
Well, that just happened to be one I was listening to this morning because it came out this week, and it's their first album in like 10 years. So what an exciting thing, right? I'm listening to, like, there's a new album by Belle and Sebastian. There's a new album by Decemberists, there's a new EP by the Cheetahs. The Sloan album that came out a few months ago is probably my favorite of late, for people who like that band from Toronto called Sloan. What else am I listening to these days? Soft Science out of Sacramento are really good. Jet Black out of Quebec. Both of those bands, along with Pale Lights and the New Lines, played a festival that I put on recently in New York at the Cake Shop back in February. So that was really super fun, you know, to actually put on a show with bands who are up and coming that I really like. I mean, yeah, I'm 52 years old at this point, and I'm not supposed to like bands that only have one album out.
Right.
I'm supposed to be like, you know, like, oh, these kids today, they don't know what they're doing, or even just, you know, people half my age are just worthless. But I never think that. I always think that anybody who says that is making a mistake, because if you said that in the late 1970s, because you came up with music in the 50s and 60s, you missed out on all the stuff that meant the most to me. And I like the stuff you grew up with, too. So now that I'm in their place, I'm actually finding young bands all the time. Who else would I recommend? Gosh, there's just so many. The Rifles are amazing. Last year. Who else do I really like? I like 3-Hour Tour. They have an album coming out. You know, there's just been a billion bands.
and I was gonna say, this is, you know, this is the pitch, right? Because you know, again, your magazine is wonderful in doing detailed reviews on dozens of albums in every issue. Well, look, Jack, I know I've kept you a little late. Again,
well,
Jack,
let me just say too that we I rank them every issue. I have a top 40.
That is true. That's right. Yeah. And so, yeah, the rankings are helpful. And what I will do, and I will tell you by way of compliment, sure. I mean, when I get your issue, I will go and see if I can get a clip from each one and get a sense if I don't know the artist. And it's been wonderful for me. I think maybe my favorite artist of the ones that your magazine introduced me to is Justin Sullivan.
Meatball Army is amazing.
Yeah, just outstanding. So look, I mean, this is a separate hour that we could just talk about our favorite music, which of course is the purpose of your magazine. But I want to thank you for joining me today on the show. Again, I invite you back on the show. Kudos and congratulations on running the Big Takeover for over 30 years. Thank you for your insights, and thank you for taking time to talk to my listeners.
Well, aside from just saying thank you for putting me on, which every guest does when they're interviewed on a program, I should also say, gosh, Dave, thanks so much for saying such wonderful things about me and my work and the work of the other people who contribute to our magazine and our website. That is incredibly graceful of you, and I have to say I greatly, greatly appreciate it, and I'm really happy that you think so. Now, that's what we all aim for when we try to put out anything, is that someone else will see the worth and the effort.
Well, one of the
trying to reach past the commercial thing and give something to somebody that would really mean something to them.
And you have. And, you know, one of the cool things about Hearsay Culture and KZSU and CIS and everyone is that it's I pick the guests. And while I don't always pick people I agree with, when I have the opportunity to have someone on whose work I think is very important to my listeners and broadly that should have a wider audience, yours is there. If you get more subscriptions out of this, wonderful. But more importantly, your insights are valued. And so thank you again. And it's all sincere.
Well, that's what it's all about, because I always say people take too much for granted, both people and things. So, you know, cherish things while you have them.
That's right. Thank you much, Jack.
Thank you, Dave.
So I'm excited. We have two more shows coming up on Hearsay Culture. Next week we're going to have Javi Soiba and Pedro Rafi on ACTA and plurilateral trade and copyright infringement, and then closing this quarter should be Biela Coleman from McGill University, author of a wonderful study of Anonymous. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture this quarter, noon Wednesday specific time, by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu or by listening in the Bay Area. You can also get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to the iTunes page for CIS, where you can find not only Hearsay Culture but the other great guests. Also, you can get the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 230 prior interviews, as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, I appreciate you bearing with the Skype's challenges today. But again, I appreciate also the feedback. And if you have any feedback on the show, positive or negative, or suggestions, I welcome it. And I keep saying again now, so I'm just going to stop. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. And again, have a great day.